Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Of all the gin joints in all the world, she walks into mine.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
Michelle Lawler, Chris Wasser, and Fionnuala Jones join us once again for Movies and Booze. Good afternoon to you all.
Good afternoon.
You brought in little baby bottles today.
And one
Michelle.
Big bottle. I'm not totally mean.
Yeah, okay, all right. And this is in Rioja, they're in counselling because they can't make
they
up who they
counseling.
Are anymore.
So I was
Is this a bitter family war kind of scenario?
I was in Rioja for 4 days a couple of weeks ago, which is amazing. And first of all, like, I think I was on here saying how much I hate Rioja before. So when I said, like, it would be, if I ever was to not drink, someone would say, would you like a Rioja? And I'd say, no, I'll be all right. And so I went there thinking, you know, oh, what's all the fuss about? And I came away from it thinking I need to move to Rioja. Like, it was just so amazing and inspiring. And I think in my head, like, a lot of those kind of industrial supermarket-y wines kind of scar you a little bit. And it was about discovering all these amazing things. But I would just like to advocate for everyone should go on holidays to this place called Haro, which is the capital of Rioja, an hour south of Bilbao. And it was just like Disneyland for wine lovers. It was the most amazing place. And sometimes, has anyone been to a wine region before? You guys done any wine region?
Yeah.
Sometimes it can be like kind of intimidating or inaccessible or a bit too posh or a bit too, you can't afford anything because the wines are whatever. But what was amazing was it was just so accessible. It was full of fun wine bars, people drinking cool things, eating pinchos. It was just amazing. But what I realized when I was there, like the second day, I was like, what's going on? They're all moaning here. Yeah. Like, what are they talking? Like, what was it? And I was trying to get what the tension was. And actually, those bigger, more industrial supermarkety wines really embrace that. You know, the Crianza and the Reserva and the Gran Reserva, like those labels that they have, which are all about oak. But if you think Rioja is like 100 kilometers long, and so there's all these like mini villages, it's like Dublin, it's like just calling Dublin as opposed to all the different villages that have all the different things, or like Bordeaux has Margaux and Saint-Emilion and Pomerol. But because of the oak thing, they don't highlight the villages. Everything just gets tarred with an oak brush, and so they don't actually highlight what Mother Nature has given them, the bigger ones. It's all just about the oak. And so when I went there and people were talking about the villages and the microclimates and the texture and the wine and the grapes and capturing this, it was so exciting. I don't know if you can tell. I was like, let's move to Rioja. So anyway, so what I have is three wines, one white and two reds that are opposites. Just to highlight how amazing, if you dig slightly under the surface, like I would say only a centimetre, you don't have to go that far to find the most amazing wines.
Yeah. Was it Logrono? Was that close to where you were?
Very close.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've been there.
We did an outside broadcast from there once.
Happy days.
Inside a vineyard, and it was like a new, like the building itself, they dug a huge hole in the ground, and so you were kind of underground half the time, but it was, there was a great vista you could see. There was a place though in Logrono called La Senda de los Elefantes.
Something to do with elephants.
Yeah. Because it was this light little alleyway, but it was gorgeous. You'd stop into these places, they'd give you a little glass of wine and a mushroom. That was all they sold in each place. Then you go to the next place, they give you a different glass of wine and a little piece of salami. And the idea was you made your way up through this row. And by the time you got to the end, you were elephants.
Wow.
And everything was 150 a pop.
It was. And that's, Haro is amazing. That's the town that I was in, the capital. Slightly more than that. I don't know how many years ago you were there that was 150 a pop.
Yeah, it was maybe 12 years ago,
yeah,
I think.
But I wouldn't say it's much more expensive than that now. And what's amazing in this town of Haro, there's the railway district, which is where a lot of the wineries were built around, because it's all about, you know, getting the wine out of there, all about the export or distribution. So when you go there, all the wineries are in situ. So you can just walk around, do a cellar door and then meander up to the centre of town and go down the elephant alleyway or effectively, for want of a better description. You know, taste all the lovely wines, have some nice food. It was just crack-a-lackin'. Everyone, go to Harrow.
Okay. All right. Okay. So, sold on that. So, Masters of the Universe.
Yeah.
You liked it.
I did.
Yeah.
Who didn't?
I don't know.
I did, yeah. You are right, though. I thought it was great, and we'll get into it. But it's weird how people seem to have either loved it or hated it. And there doesn't seem to be an in-between, which is odd. But yeah, it's a live-action Masters of the Universe film, directed by the guy who gave us the only good Transformers film. There is a decent Transformers film. It's called Bumblebee.
It's yes. kind of, yeah, it is kind a good of, film. Yeah.
It's like E.T. if, you know, if the alien was a robot. And yeah, Travis Knight, he's like the head of Leica Animation. He is the heir to the Nike Inc. Corporation, married to an Irish woman too, so he's one of us. And yeah, he's given us this surprisingly entertaining live-action He-Man where we don't actually have to look at Jared Leto as Skeletor. We listen to him, but we don't get to see him. So that's an extra star for me. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
But does it know what it is?
Oh, it absolutely does.
And the original was, you know...
Yeah, yeah. I mean...
Wink, to put it mildly.
Oh, yeah, and this one is the same. I mean, they could never have played this thing straight. And I'd say that they were raging that the guys at Marvel got to do what they did with Thor Ragnarok and Thor, you know, was it Love and Thunder? In that, you know, here's a hero who is, you know, here's this kind of swords and sorcery tale full of all these, you know, unbelievably cartoonish figures. There's no point in playing this like a Shakespeare. Let's have a bit of fun with it. Let's embrace the campness. And that's what this thing is doing. Yeah. So we're looking at that. We're looking at Savage House.
Yeah.
Period comedy. It's about a couple of crooks and chancers in 18th century England who will do anything to climb to the top of the social ladder. And that includes, you know, eating and drinking and humping anything in sight.
Yeah.
Richard E. Grant and Claire Foy.
Yeah. Which should be good, but
we'll get to it.
Yeah, we'll get to it. Now, Master of the Universe, you could easily see RuPaul in that, but RuPaul's gone their own direction.
Yeah, RuPaul's been in the cinematic universe before, but this new film, Stop That Train, which actually isn't, it's not getting a theatrical release here or in the UK, as far as I'm aware, but I imagine it'll be like a straight-to-streaming jobby, although I do think that was a missed opportunity. The director of Stop That Train, Adam Shankman, has had to come out and refute claims that generative AI was used in this film. So Stop That Train, if anyone hasn't seen the trailer or isn't familiar with RuPaul or RuPaul's Drag Race, it's basically like Airplane, but with loads and loads of drag queens and like gay-adjacent, like funny people, essentially. And there were kind of these... social media whispers started essentially where I think it actually came from a Letterboxd review of the film from someone who said, also, if the film wasn't bad enough on its own, it's one of the most conspicuous uses of AI I've seen in a film, with a lot of VFX looking like generative AI, and doubt about how much of the obvious stock footage might also be, because in the end credits there is a company credited called Acme AI. They're billed as like the top VFX company on the film. So they've had to, as I said, Adam Shankman has now to come out and say every shot in Stop That Train was made by human hands. It's come to my attention there's some online speculation full of generative AI, says there are some total of zero shots conceived by AI. Acme AI is this firm founded by someone called Ryan Kavanaugh, and basically what they're suggesting Acme AI does, because I know you were talking about this yesterday with Martin Scorsese and him getting in on the AI thing as well. What Acme AI does, or says they do, is that they shorten production schedules and help reduce budgets by filming on kind of like a grey box downstage, and then AI generates the background. I think there's one film coming up called Bitcoin where they've done that. Now, apparently, that's not what they did with Stop That Train. There's another source spoke to Variety this week that said that they were contracted for, that it was kind of about workflow processes. So as opposed to actually making the images, they were just kind of helping the processes go more smoothly. Now, some people have taken this statement to say that it's kind of worded very specifically, as if it was, you know, yes, a human came up with the shot of, and I haven't seen the film, so like this could be fake. RuPaul plays the president. So like we'll say it's RuPaul as Madam President and the white whatever. Like the way they've phrased it is, oh yeah, a human did come up, like a human came up with that. But there's nothing to say then that a human didn't come up with it and then put it into a thing and then it was generated.
If it comes to special effects though, isn't it fair game to use AI, because that would be done via a computer anyway? It's not like there's any human drawing anything.
No, none of someone's losing out on the job, and most of the time they are.
That's the thing.
That's the issue. But anyway, like, people in America are going to go see this anyway, so I don't think it really matters. But
and can you tell?
Yeah. Can you really yeah. tell? Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever passed a billboard and gone, that's AI?
I think it's so obvious, even on a smaller level, we'll say, with like social media and stuff. Or even there was a Casey Musgraves did a performance at the Country Music Awards recently, and the whole, it's for her song Dry Spell, and the whole thing is she's in a grocery store and she's looking around, and she's, because she doesn't have a boyfriend, whatever, and all the posters on the stage were made with AI. And I think people kind of came out and were like, girl, because she would be considered kind of a quote unquote progressive country star, and I don't think she really kind of, I think she essentially ignored all that criticism, but it is glaringly obvious now, like podcast descriptions, everything. Like,
copy is easy to tell.
Yeah.
You can tell there's some words, or like the M dash, you know, that long hyphen that you see that is unique to ChatGPT. When I see that, I'm like, come on, you didn't even edit the M dash.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like you can tell, I find it lazy when you read something and you're like, oh, look, it's like whatever the words are.
Still though, when it comes to making, it's money though, and it'll boil down to, it's cheaper.
Well, like,
to
that Boots Riley came out about Martin Scorsese, because obviously his whole thing is like the AI company that he's involved with about storyboarding. It's, you know, he wants to, you know, it'll save money and it'll be a better film in the long run. Boots Riley came out and was like, he doesn't care, and this is obviously Boots Riley's opinion, but they were like, Martin Scorsese doesn't care, he got a boatload of money. That's all, that's, you know, he's a vested interest in it. That's why, like, it's, we're on a very slippery slope here.
And it's very slippery. Anyway, Michelle, tell us about our first
wine.
Let's do that, yes.
Okay, let's do that.
Go mad.
Okay, so the first wine we're going to have is a white Rioja. Okay, so this is from a producer called Allegra Valganen. And this is from a town just west. And so when you go to this town of Harrow, and you go to the smaller producers, they're all within a 15-minute driving distance if you were to go outside of the main region. But I would say if you're in Harrow, you can stay there and do all the cellar door stuff in situ, which is super. So this is, there's a concept. Have you ever heard of a garage wine before?
No.
We used to talk about it in Bordeaux years ago, where the wine was literally made in a garage. And this is garage wine in the coolest way.
Oh, is that what I interviewed a woman at the start of the show who's been growing vines in her front garden in Donnycarney.
Okay.
No, really. She's been doing it for years.
But for like aesthetic reasons or to eat grapes?
No, she makes wine. She grows the vines. Her son gave it to her as a present. She grows the vines and she started, and she hadn't a clue, like, but she was figured it out. She looked it up on YouTube, how to make wine. Yeah. But she's been doing it for years. Now it's 9%-ish kind of thing.
Yeah, it wouldn't get too hot to get the grapes ripe.
Yeah.
But effectively, this is garage wine. And so when we arrived, sometimes you go to wineries and they're big and glam and you know you're arriving at a winery. And this one, it was just, we were in this town and there were 42 abandoned wineries in it. Because a lot of the grapes get sold. Like, I think it's about 80% of all the grapes grown in the Rioja region get sold again to the big supermarket guys. Mm. And so a lot of it's just quantity and not quality. So these particular guys, so we knocked on their door and then they opened up and we were in this really cool garage. Actually, they had done it really well. There was a cool table and a little kitchen. And this guy was an engineer but from Rioja, and then kind of came back to his roots. And it was him and his wife, and he was doing all the nice entertaining, and his wife was literally out in the fields like pruning and stuff, so doing all the hard graft. But he makes these wines, and when you try it, you'll feel texturally it's quite soft and creamy. Mm. Now, I brought the white just to do something a little bit different. They do some beautiful reds. Like, they were probably, we had tried the night before we went to these guys out in a wine bar, one of their wines by accident, and it was like texturally stunning, like velvety, layered, dense, nuanced. They were just so exciting. And when we met him, so his vineyard's 500 to 600 meters above sea level, which means that you get a little bit more freshness in the wines. This particular wine, I thought was exciting. So the grape Tempranillo, which is the main grape in Rioja, it's a red grape. And most Riojas that you're ever going to taste are going to be 70% this red grape. This is a white Rioja, but there's white Tempranillo in it. And in 1988, some guy was out in his vineyards, and there was like this mad vine evolution, and one vine turned to start producing white grapes.
Like,
just from evolution. And in all the instances of all the times I'm in wine nearly 25 years, I've never heard of a grape just changing.
Spontaneously doing it.
Yeah, it's amazing. And so they snipped it, took a snip, and then propagated it. And so now it's planted, but it's not planted very widely. But what you get from it, and from this one, I would say White Rioja was tar, like scarred with this kind of like bad vanilla flavor, you know, in the 80s and the 90s. Whereas now they're very much like that new wave of Chardonnay, where they're kind of soft, buttery, a little bit of those cream vanilla notes, nice acidity. So for me, this one, the Allegra Volgannon, it's kind of like a Macon. Now, I would say, admittedly, it's a little bit warm. It was very warm coming into town today, so it was cold, and now it's room temperature. But I just think it's a really cool way, if you like exploring white wines, if you like Chardonnay, and I know it's a dirty word, but it's a clean word for me. I love Chardonnay. Call me Chardonnay. It's a really gorgeous example of something really exciting, produced to an extremely high standard, a very good value for money. And what you see with it, and I find, you know this phrase, that's a real food wine. Have you ever heard that phrase? I'd say I was in the wine trade 8 years before I realised what that meant. I used to just agree and go, yeah, definitely. Yeah. What does a food wine mean? And so when you have a taste of that, and if you just have a taste now, and you'll see, I need something else. I think it's the easiest way to describe it.
Yeah, yeah.
I need something else. And so based now that we don't have water in front of us, we don't have food in front of us, but we do have wine, you'll end up taking another sip of wine.
Yeah.
But in actual fact, when you say, oh, that's a food wine, it means it needs something else. So a little bit of protein or cream in that will, you get this amazing.
A little bit of
amazing,
cheese might be nice with it.
Yeah. You get this amazing mathematical equation called 1 + 1 = 3. Where the wine tastes better and the food tastes better together. And that's what like a food wine is. But it is, it's a really, it's kind of like wine nonsense lingo-y jargon stuff that, you know, that God, what does that something. Actually mean?
But this fella with his garage, how many bottles would he be producing?
Oh, sure. I'll go into my notes after this because I was so excited by this whole thing. Very few. They might even have.
That was, yeah.
Hold on. This is, this particular wine, they've put it on the back of the bottle, actually, super cool. 10,900 bottles. And just to give you an example, in Champagne, they make 300 million. Okay.
Whoa, yeah.
So, and you think Champagne is something really rare and special. Yeah. It's not. It's like, you know, industrial commercial. This guy's made 10,000. So it's probably just a handful of barrels. This is bottled 2,738. And I would just like to say something mental about this endeavor, right? To put your bottle number on your label means you've had to make 10,900 individual labels. In it, like I always find it amazing when someone's gone to that endeavor of individually.
Well, he probably got the wife to do that as well while he was entertaining people in his garage.
But the wine is amazing. It's a really, they've a few different wines. I just found the value in it very, very high for what you're tasting and just, you know, you are tasting this guy in his plots of land and he's not trying to say, OK, I'm going to put a Crianza on it. And that's the most important thing is to get the oak in. The oak is how it's all about capturing. What did nature give me in that year? How am I going to let that just taste amazing? And then there is a little bit of oak in this, but it's just, I think, part of culturally what's happening. But ultimately, this wine, Allegra Volgannon, go try some. It's exciting.
Chris, by the power of Grayskull?
He-Man.
Yes, let's talk about He-Man after this.
Well said, Lord Skeletor. Poetry.
A tick in the ways is done. With the new dawn, Eternia shall witness my rise. That's it. I've finished.
Of course, my lord.
When I raise my fist like that, I'm done.
Yes.
That is the crescendo.
You'll know for the future, my lord.
That was Masters of the Universe. He-Man and co are in their skimpy pants in cinemas from today. Is it a kind of a origin story? Or
It isn't. It isn't. I mean, it's weird that Travis Knight has been able to make a film that's open to you know, hardcore fans of He-Man. There are a lot of them. There have been since the like mid 1980s, and complete newcomers. That they've been able to kind of honor the absurd animated legacy of this thing, which started off as a toy. If you bought a He-Man action figure in 1982, it came with a tiny little comic that explains the history of Eternia, and this is where He-Man came from.
It was before that, not the other way around.
It was Mattel, and they came up with the toy, then the comic, and then there was an animated series. So it really is, this is another film, you know, based on a Mattel toy. But they've found, Travis Knight and his team have figured out a way to honor that, to honor the people who have been, you know, with this thing for 40 odd years, and also to make a simple, straightforward fantasy that you and I could go into and go, okay, and that I can explain the plot to now without, you know, falling over.
Okay, great.
So you've got this young prince, Adam, who lives in Eternia. Where's Eternia? It's off over there in the universe. It's off over there. And he lives a very happy life until Skeletor, who's this wicked warlock without you know, skin on his face. He comes along and just spoils everyone's fun. And he challenges the king to a battle. The king loses. He imprisons the mom. And this good sorceress comes along and says, Adam, here you go. Here's the Sword of Power. I'm going to open up this portal over here. Off you pop. We'll come and get you, or, you know, we'll see you whenever. So poor Adam, like, ends up on
a bit loosey goosey. I'm
simplifying this thing for you. Yeah. So Adam ends up on Earth, and don't ask me what he does over the next 15 years. We kind of fast forward to 20 something Adam, played by a very buff Nicholas Galitzine. You might know Nicholas Galitzine from The Idea of You, Red, White and Royal Blue, and also Handsome Devil, which was one of his first films. Great actor. And I did stop for a second, go, what happened when He-Man, as a kid, got to Earth? I mean, who picked him up and who looked after him? And where's, you know, where's the Martha Kent here? Where's what's the story? Yeah. Like, I want to know, like, where he went to school. Never mind that. We might get to it in the sequel. All we know is that, at, you know, at 25, 26, whatever he is, he's obsessed with his past on Eternia. And he's constantly talking to his roommate about it, his workmates. He goes on a date and that's all he ever talks about. And everyone
Do people just accept that? Or they think he's bonkers?
They think he's mad, But for some reason, he's landed quite a good job in human resources at this, you know,
So, you come from another dimension where you're royalty, and you come to this fairly backward planet, and you take a job in HR.
They make for the best HR people, apparently. Yeah. But he actually doesn't. We're led to believe that he's good at his job, but that he also spends most of his time in his job looking for the Sword of Power. Because the one thing he was told before he went in that portal, that very important portal, was don't lose the sword. Oh. He did lose the sword.
Oh, womp womp.
I know.
Well, he's not really a good recruit then for HR if he's losing the most important thing.
This synopsis is not going the way I planned. Listen, long story short, he finds the sword in a comic book shop.
Phew.
Ends up back in Eternia, thinks everything's going to be all right. It's not. Skeletor has had his way.
I thought his parents were imprisoned by Skeletor. Why would he think everything would be okay?
I think he forgot about that bit, Sean.
Oh, okay. Does it explain how he lost the sword?
He lost it when he crash landed on Earth. The sword went one direction and he went in another. Yeah. So he ends up back in Eternia, and that's where he has to become He-Man. That's where he has to become a superhero, and his friends will help him. He's got this drunk general played by Idris Elba. He's got one guy named Fisto and another guy called Ram Man. And if you think I'm not going to make fun of that film, think again. Or those names, think again.
Yeah.
The film certainly does.
Does Fisto and Ram Man, they come from Earth?
No.
The porn film dimension.
They live on Eternia, but the jokes about their names definitely come from Earth.
Okay.
So they all band together and they face off against Skeletor. Now, you might think that there's a few things about the film that might annoy people. The runtime is 140 minutes. That's far too much. Some people might think the plot that I've just tried to describe and probably failed at is a bit too stupid. It is. There's no arguments there. And some people might be put off by Mr. Box Office Poison himself, Jared Leto. What I will say is I'm willing to forgive the runtime because of how entertaining this thing is. I am just going to again repeat that Jared Leto, you don't have to look at him here, and because of that it's actually his best performance. This film requires a real panto villain, someone who's not going to take the material seriously but who's going to overdo it on everything. The performance, the voice, everything. You know, he's playing Skeletor as this slippery, insecure man-child, and it works. It's so very, very funny. I mean, you just got a snippet of it there. That's not the funniest bit, there are better. I mean, at one point Skeletor ends up in the human resources department where He-Man works, and it's just fantastic.
Okay, that's good.
So, and as for the stupid bit, again, I'm not going to argue with you, but it's good that Travis Knight and the team, they clearly sat down and said, we can't play this thing straight.
Yeah.
We have to embrace that campness. We have to embrace the silly side. And we also, we kind of have to make fun of ourselves here. I mean, Dolph Lundgren shows up at one point. He was the original He-Man in the first He-Man film, which is not worth a revisit at all. But he is part of this team that are making fun of Masters of the Universe without ever being mean or disrespectful to the source material, or, you know, the people who basically lined this franchise's pocket from day one. And that's a very difficult thing to do. And the fact that they've succeeded at that, I, you know, hats off. And I think they've struck gold getting Nicholas Galitzine to play this guy as someone who's quite odd and a little dim and just, you know, very innocent. He stopped growing up when he arrived on Earth. He just remained a kid in a very large man's body. But Nicholas Galitzine plays that part very, very well. Better than, I was going to say, like, think when you think of this film, think Thor Ragnarok meets Flash Gordon, but kind of, you know, smarter and funnier than those two. Definitely funnier than Flash Gordon. I love the stuff on Earth. I like the fact that when he's on Earth, you've got this soundtrack from the 80s and 90s. You've got, you know, Four Non Blondes. You've got The Cure's Boys Don't Cry incorporated into the soundtrack. You've also got Brian May on there too. The action is quite clean and coherent. I think Idris Elba is having the most fun that he has ever had on the set of a film. You can see it. Again, they have this running gag involving He-Man's, you know, job in human resources, which never failed to put a smile on my face. And also, it never forgets, unlike several Marvel films, that this is supposed to be a cartoon. Yeah, and cartoons are inherently entertaining. This entertained me so much more than I expected it to. And a little bit like, you know, I don't want to mention this film because this film just completely flops, but it didn't deserve to. It's a little bit like Dungeons and Dragons, that you come away from this.
So good.
Oh, it was fantastic. Yeah, you really come away from a fantasy film like that, that has such clever ideas and really committed performances and such, you know, intelligent writing, that you go, I want to see more of this. And we didn't with that one. But with this, I came out and went, sequel. Give us a sequel. I will happily take a sequel. I don't know if we're going to get it because it's not exactly tracking for, you know, mega numbers at the box office. But I really do hope that people show up for it.
Okay. So I'm taking from that. Skeletor doesn't die in the end then, or is that a spoiler? Look,
Skeletor can always come back. I can't believe I'm saying this, but if Jared Leto wants to come back for Masters of the Universe.
I understand why, you know, there'd be diehard Marvel fans and superhero fans who would have been into the comics and the films and all the rest, but are there like diehard Masters of the Universe
fans? Apparently so, yeah. I attended a screening. I have a story.
I know someone who is obsessed with this film and obsessed with the previous film that you kind of lightly disparaged, which I agree with, but yeah.
Okay. Right.
Like vehemently into this, so
I was at the,
but I don't know if it was the film or the toys. I don't know if it was like chicken or egg situation or the outfits. Yeah, absolutely. But
yeah, I was at the premiere screening of this, and the room was filled with you know, clearly like hardcore fans of He-Man, and it was actually lovely to see them have such a great time, like applauding with it, but not in that sort of way that annoys you when people, but you know, having a great time with this character finally, because the previous stuff felt terrible. So yeah, they exist, Sean.
After decades of disappointment, they're
He-Man
finally
delivers.
Yeah. So Euphoria is no more. Was there criticism of the final season or the final edition even?
Yeah. Like, I stopped halfway through because it was just, I mean, if I want to watch a woman get degraded, I'll open my selfie camera. You know what I mean? Like, it was just, it was a lot even for me. And we've talked about how the show was kind of, you know, obviously there was a huge wait between season two and season three. We had Labyrinth leave. There was like a lot of other cast members dropped off. There was lots of industry reporting around Zendaya and Sam Levinson, the creator, writer, director, basically doing everything on this last season as well, how they were kind of clashing and their kind of vision for this third season didn't pan out. At one point, they were going to make Rue a private detective. For anyone that's not familiar with Euphoria, Rue in Euphoria was a teenage drug addict. So I don't know how we get from there to there, but I digress. They didn't do that in the end. And I won't spoil the third season if anyone is still watching or whatever. But it really got to a place of the characters like didn't make sense. The writing was super thin. It was really clear there was no writer's room. I mean, it was always a bit, you know, out there in terms of glorification of sex, drugs, rock and roll, etc., etc. And that was criticised. But like this, like really cranked it up to a, I don't know, it just felt like Sam Levinson was like, I want to make a Tarantino TV series and I want it to look a specific way without any kind of, you know, any interest in anything else. And like some of the actors are doing the best they can. Like I think Zendaya is like doing fine with what she has. I actually think Sydney Sweeney also doing well with what she has, but the you'd argue the material there, because she, again, her character, Cassie's character, is moving into sex work and becoming just this like caricature of what a sex worker is, and they're constantly naked and it kind of doesn't really make sense. Jacob Elordi as Nate, kind of the high school bully turned Stepford husband kind of thing. Doesn't make any sense. He has nothing to do. It's bonkers. I gave up. I was like, right, enough, whatever. But I wasn't. There seemed to be a lot of other people who stuck with it. And I know a lot of other people colloquially who were like, I've watched enough of this. I need to see it to the end. So I think the final season ended up getting like 25 million worldwide viewers, which is actually up from season two. I think it was up 17%. Hmm. Now, the way they look at that, though, is obviously HBO Max has kind of launched in more territories as well. So the kind of scope of how people can access it is bigger. And also the way they measure viewing is like so, it's like they'll view it for 90 days after the release, shall we say. And the finale wasn't even like the most watched episode. It was like the middle episode where, this isn't really a spoiler because it's been heavily touted, but like Nate and Cassie get married. It's like their wedding. Just a strange... Sam Levinson's been doing kind of the rounds now this week. He's on a couple of podcasts like... talking about it and kind of pushing against the backlash, and Sydney Sweeney's come out and said, you know, is kind of singing his praises. Alexa Demi, who was kind of one of the other stars who people thought this would be a launch, the show would be a launch pad for her, but it kind of hasn't been. She has also this big profile in The Hollywood Reporter where she kind of doesn't say anything, but also is kind of like, I like Sam. Anytime I wasn't comfortable with the nudity, he was like, cool. It's just such a weird, considering this show had such a big legacy. I think the Rotten Tomatoes critics consensus was like 72%. For the second season, and it's down to like 42% in the third season.
Ooh,
like that's it.
Yeah.
And look, people will say, there are people who say the show was never good, and I do get it was like crazy, it was bonkers. Mm. But there was something, it was anchored in that performance by Zendaya of being an addict. There was a lot of like forward progressive stuff around, you know, like Hunter Schafer, a trans actor playing a trans character. There was like good stuff there, and it just like, is it Sam at the wheel being this kind of, I'm the ultimate auteur, I want to make something and it's going to look like this. Just yes. Kind of, like letting the wheels run off it. I don't know. It's just such a shame. It went really, like it was half Western, half, I don't know what, that, like genuinely, like it was great. Like Rue was running a strip club in this season. I don't know. Like it's, and look, again, they had to face a lot of things. Like they lost members of the cast, COVID, writer strike, etc., etc. But it just feels like one man's ego to create the.
Yeah.
Because he's like a nepo baby as well. Like his dad is Barry Levinson, who's like very involved in films and stuff like that. Just kind of desperate to create something. I don't know.
Might it be a factor that all the many of those actors that you mentioned went on to, you know, bigger and better things. Well, bigger things at least. It was probably harder to get them all, you know, back for the third season, and maybe there were time constraints, and it was almost like knocking it out, really, because people would like to see one.
Yeah, I still think they could have made a... I don't think time constraints is the only thing here.
But somebody texted to say Euphoria is still better than Heated Rivalry.
Lies.
Wow, controversial.
You can't say that during Pride. Yeah. It's June.
Oh, yeah, it's true, yeah. While Fionnuala goes off to get her big woke gun to shoot that person, we're going to take a break. Coming back with more Movies and Booze. Two wines in front of us, so you're putting it up to us.
Yes, so what we have are two Rioja. And what I realised, having had my gorgeous 4 days, if anyone had missed that, I've been for 4 days in Rioja.
I think you mentioned it, yes.
Just in case you haven't got the memo. So what I realised was obviously that there were these the industrial guys hanging on the Crianza and the Reserva and the Grand Reserva. And then there were these like trailblazing people who were really fighting up the stream about what they believe the best potential of Rioja could be. And yet I feel like nearly don't have like the megaphone to talk about how amazing that capacity is. So the two wines that I have in front of me are probably two of the biggest in the, you know, change makers, wave makers. One is Remaluri and one is Vina Tondonia. But they do totally different things. So Vina Tondonia arrived, the family Lopez de Heredia, in Rioja 150 years ago, and originally miners from Argentina. And so when you go to the winery, if you're allowed in, we were allowed in by appointment only, told not to take any photographs. And if you did, you weren't allowed to publish them. It's done like they made wine 150 years ago. And the way they make their wine is they have very few vineyards. They haven't really acquired anything. They're still doing it as they have been doing. And they leave the wine in oak for a really, really long time. Because what they want when the wine comes to the market is for it to be in perfect, optimum drinking condition. absolutely perfect. You don't have to hold on to it. This is the wine that you can open now and, you know, mark your moment, have a special occasion. And this is the Vina Tondonia. And I was just going to check. So this is the Reserva. And I can't see the year on it. 2013. So their current release is 13 years old. And when you look at the glass that we have in front of us, it's kind of a light, kind of a reddy brown. They call it brick brown is the technical wine term. And it's all about those kind of spicy nuances. It's quite light. And there's a phrase, sometimes you hear about a wine being made with a feminine touch. And they tend to be wines that are just a little bit more delicate than you might say if something was muscular, it would be a lot richer. But they're just this really cool winery that age all their wines for a really long time. And what you get is a wine, because you know, they sometimes you think, oh, I'd love a wine from that year, or in my case, I'd like to keep it, but I just drink them. So this is actually, I know, we don't really hold wine at home because they just get opened. But if you want to have a wine that's a little bit more mature, having wines like this, where they're that much older, like they're just, it is like tasting a little piece of history. Their top wine, which is a Gran Reserva, which goes for in and around 200 euro. The current release is 2004, and that got 100 points when it was scored recently. And
wow.
Like that's okay. Like saying it's perfect. And then the other wine that I have is from Remoulouri. And so whereas the Vina Tondonia, the Lopez de Heredia, is like stuck in history. The Remoulouri wines, and I would call them both dynasties, are all about the future and what the future would look like. And so these guys have vineyards in all the different main villages, and they produce what they call the Lindes de Remoulouri. And so what you can do is taste all the different villages and the individual expression of how amazing it is. And just to finish, that if you wanted to drink some wine at the weekend, buy some Rioja. It's delicious.
It's delicious. There
she goes.
On
our website, New Wine Co. and good independent wine shops.
Okay, thanks, Michelle. Right, let's move on to our second movie. It is, what's it called again?
Savage House.
The Savage House. Here's a clip.
The Duke and Duchess are coming for dinner.
Really? The Duke and Duchess of Devonshire tonight?
Oh. We were chosen. This is our chance to restore your family name. To rewrite history without anyone being the wiser, save for a few debt collectors.
Where is he?
Stephen Brigand!
Mama, you're going to send us to the poorhouse if you keep this up.
This is madness.
But isn't it fun?
Oh, he's good, isn't he?
There you go. So would this be like Downton Abbey bought an eight ball?
yeah, with a little bit of Barry Lyndon thrown in, and also maybe the kind of sweary debauchery of the great. So what we have here is a story about how the Duke and the Duchess of Devonshire have decided to visit this aristocratic home where nobody of any importance actually lives, because the place that they were originally going to stay when they came to this part of the country, there's a smallpox outbreak.
Okay.
So you've got these absolute chancers. You've got Sir Chauncey Savage, who is just beside himself with excitement because all of his life he's just been, you know, this fraudster and a fool. And he only married Lady Savage, played by Claire Foy, because of her fortune. And somehow in a few very short years, he's managed to, you know, spend that entire fortune on, you know, booze and brothels and betting. So they are looking at, you know, they'll lose their home, they'll lose everything they have. But when the Duke and Duchess of Devonshire write a letter saying we're coming to stay with you guys, they're like, well, this could be it. This could be the thing that saves us from public embarrassment, and that also kind of, you know, keeps us in nice frocks and keeps us at nice parties. And hey, we might even use the money that we earn from this to go and move to Paris. So they think, right, okay, they're coming in a week and a half, let's get the gaff ready. So they go, they're very hard at work and getting the house ready. And when I say they're very hard at work, their workers are very hard at work.
Yes.
So they have just two of them, Reginald Halifax, who is Chauncey's right hand man, played by Jack Farthing, and then Dorothy Neville Bell Powley, who is Lady Savage's helper around the house, and they do everything. They're doing everything they can to kind of get the house ready. But what the Savages don't know is that the two of them are in cahoots. They're actually lovers, and they have this secret plan to violently overturn the Savages and to, you know, push them off the ladder and make them make their way up. And in doing that, they're kind of tricking each Savage into thinking that they're in love with them. So everybody here is having affairs with everybody else.
Okay.
Although it's not really affairs, they're all just kind of hanging about the garden, rubbing off one another. It's very, very, you know exactly what the kind of thing we're getting here. Would it be too, I mentioned the smallpox outbreak, would it be too much to mention that there's also a political revolution over the hills?
Okay.
Maybe. There's an awful lot going on in this thing. And if I've made it sound like it's a hoot, I'm very, very sorry, because I thought that's what I thought that's what it was going to be. Because on paper, it just sounds like this pitch black comedy that is going to make you laugh, that has this rotten heart, this very sweary follow through, these great performers at its center. It's going to be juicy. It's going to be right. It's going to, you know, it's going to entertain you. It really doesn't. I found that it just kind of writes and talks itself into a corner. It's very wordy. It's a bit too flat. The satire isn't as sharp as I think the filmmaker Peter Glantz thinks it is. Nobody could ever accuse Richard E. Grant of phoning it in.
Yeah, that's true.
Whatever the role, however big that role is, he always delivers. And he's pulling every funny, scary face imaginable here. And yeah, you would. You watch him all day. And Claire Foy, I'm still waiting for Claire Foy to land a film role worthy of her talents, because maybe outside of The Crown, the only thing that I've ever kind of come away from and thought, yeah, that was pretty great, was First Man. But even that was kind of a small role for her. She's always a professional. She always delivers. I just wish she, you know, again, you had the material there to kind of, you know, match her talents. Even the supporting players here, everyone is committed to the bit. I just found the whole thing just a little bit pointless. I don't think it's as funny or as sharp or as engaging as it thinks it is.
Okay. So you'd Masters of the Universe.
Masters of the Universe.
You're going to make a choice this weekend.
Get your loincloth on.
Yeah, get your loincloth on. That's the way to do it. Thanks to Fionnuala and Michelle and Chris. That's our lot for today.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Of all the gin joints in all the world, she walks into mine.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.